This is a chunk of Revelation that's organized around the number 7. We've already been acquainted with number 7 right from the beginning of the book of Revelation. Number 7 is a number that means fullness or completeness. It means the whole package is there. What we have in this section of these sections of Revelation are three series of judgments that are all based on the number 7, or there are 7 judgments in each cycle of judgments, each of 3 cycles of judgments. And the first cycle of judgment has to do with the opening of 7 seals. Those aren't circus seals with balls on their nose, but seals from that scroll that was handed, or that was brought forward in heaven. The scroll that had the secret of the meaning of life and the meaning of history in it. What's the meaning of our suffering is the question that we on earth are asking. In the book of Revelation, we on earth who are asking this question are members of congregations in the west part of Turkey, in cities like Ephesus and Smyrna, Sardis, Thyatira, Philadelphia, Laodicea, 7 cities that are in the western part of Turkey, 2 on the coast and the other ones all on the Roman road that you would go on if you were walking from one place to another or taking a chariot or doing something else like that. These are the 7 churches that received letters at the beginning of the book of Revelation, and the letters were there in the order that a person would have come to them on that Roman road. And when those 7 churches got their letters, there was a specific message for each church that had to do with their particular situation. But it became clear from all of those letters that these churches in Western Turkey at this time, which is close to the end of the first century, are in trouble. There's external trouble to begin with. The Roman Empire is proud and strong and mighty. Rome, through its armies and its bureaucratic system, is in charge of the whole area around the Mediterranean, and they have an iron fist. They control the legal system, the economic system, to some extent the social system. And one thing that they're trying to do now to cement their power around the Mediterranean is get all the people, because we're all of different ethnic backgrounds and different, we don't all speak Latin, we're not all Roman or of the same race as the Romans are by birth. One thing Rome is trying to get us to do in order to submit to them more is worship the emperor. That would be a uniting factor, don't you think, if we all worship the same God? And of course we know, don't we? At least we're being told that the Roman emperor is a god. It's not just the expression of God's will on earth, although that's true enough in itself, and that enough should be that alone should be enough to make us agree to what Rome says. Well, the Roman emperor is actually saying, I am God and you are going to worship me. And if you don't, there are going to be serious consequences, socially, economically, politically. You're not going to be able to own property, you're not going to be able to run a business unless you worship the emperor and agree to the system. But what's the system? Part and parcel of the system is that people are slaving away so that 5% of the people at the top of the Roman system can be rich and famous and do whatever they want to do. The rest of us are having trouble putting food on our tables, are having trouble figuring out how to feed our families, and are being persecuted for what makes us unique and individual, our own religious heritage, our own special way of seeing the world, our own uniqueness. And so, with that kind of situation, we're sitting around in our congregations in Western Turkey saying, what are we going to do about this? Are we going to agree to worship the Roman emperor? Or are we going to stick to what we have been confessing, the faith we've been baptized into? Jesus Christ is the emperor, the ruler of the universe, not the Roman system. And that Jesus values an ethic of listening to the oppressed, of helping those who are in trouble, is the way life ought to be run. And not this fantastic system that disenfranchises so many people. So we're really struggling with how to live as God's faithful people. And when these seven letters come to us and are read among us, and all of them would be read to each church, we hear not only this special message for our church, but the message for all the other churches as well. Seven is the number of completeness. And anyone who has ears to hear should hear what God is saying to the churches. And now we can switch and be who we are at Holden Village again and not think of ourselves as the people back in Thyatira or Philadelphia. Because seven is the number of completeness, and if we find something in this scripture that illuminates our lives in the world today as well, the same message is there for us. Let those who have ears to hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. Well, this number of completeness, this number seven, is the structure of these series of judgments. And the meaning of these judgments seems, the bottom line seems to be that God is going to overcome evil and get rid of it, finally. This is what a project God has been working on for a long time. And we, as the people in Philadelphia, Thyatira, and so on, know that evil is really rampant in the world. We, as the people at Holden Village, know that evil is really rampant in the world. It's not named Rome anymore. But it's named militarism, racism, sexism, greed, exploitation of the poor, war, poverty, hunger. Still a project that God is working on. And we will now look at these series of judgments that is illustrated in the book of Revelation and try to connect with whether or how God might still be working in the same way now. I'm going to give you an overview of all these, and then we'll look at some of them in more detail, because of course this is a big chunk to cover, to bite off at one time and to chew on. But there's some fascinating details in here. Part of the problem of reading Revelation is that some of the details are so puzzling and fascinating that you can get lost in the trees and not see the forest. So for just a minute, I'm going to try to look at the forest, and then we'll go in and look at some of the trees more closely. The first cycle of judgment is when the seals on this scroll are opened. The Lamb takes them off one by one, or breaks them one by one. Every time one is broken, something happens. And the first four seals result in what's called the four horsemen of the apocalypse coming forth. Apocalypse is the same word as Revelation. Apocalypse is Greek. Revelation is a Latin-based word. And so here are the four horsemen of the apocalypse at the beginning of chapter 6. Now, put your, if you have a Bible, please look at this and practice your skills as biblical interpreters. Then I saw the Lamb open one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures, this is gathered around the throne of God, call out as with a voice of thunder, "Come." I looked, and there was a white horse. Its rider had a bow, a crown was given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer. What does this horse represent? With a bow, conquering and to conquer? Power. Specifically, military power or invasion. Next horse. Second seal. Out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth so that people would slaughter one another. And he was given a great sword. What's this horse? Thank you. Third, there was a black horse. Its rider held a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, this is kind of like the editorial comment on this rider with the scales in his hand, "A quart of wheat for a day's pay and three quarts of barley for a day's pay, but do not damage the olive oil and the wine." This is perfectly clear, isn't it? But think about it. A quart of wheat, four cups of wheat, that much wheat, for a whole day's pay? Is that fair? If you work for a whole day and you get this much in payment, are you going to be able to stay alive? A quart of wheat is about enough rations for one person. What if you have a spouse and children, and maybe other people who help you work your farm or something like that? Is this going to do it? This is runaway inflation, folks. I mean, if you don't want to live on wheat, you can have barley, and you can get a little more barley for a day's wages. But it's not going to be a very good life. So, inflation, this is an economic system gone awry. And what's that business about the oil and the wine? There are two general interpretations of that. And now you can hear the two options, and then you can pick based on the context or based on what you think is true. Some people say, do not harm the oil and the wine is a statement of mercy here. Kind of like, you know, it may cost a lot to get oil and wheat, but at least, or to get wheat and barley, but at least let there be something that's pure and not adulterated. The other interpretation says, what we're talking about here, folks, is a plantation system where you are slaving away to raise these cash crops for export. You're tending the olive trees, you're tending the vineyards, and the wine's going to be sent to for those banquets in Rome, and the olive oil is going to go to anoint some rich people at the spas near Mount Vesuvius or something like that. And all you're going to get for all your slave labor is a quart of wheat for a day's wages. So, let's vote. Do you think it's a sign of mercy, don't harm the oil and the wine, or do you think it's a sign of the exploitation that was happening of the farm workers?
Yes.
Okay, if you vote for this over number two, raise your hand. How many people voting for number one? Aha. You see how good you are as biblical interpreters. And I think that's how you read Revelation in large part. If there's something puzzling, you kind of say, well, do I get any clues from anywhere else? Or what's the sense of this whole passage? What forest is it that I'm in when I'm looking at this tree? So that's just what you do. Then the fourth seal. I looked and I have the new RSV translation here, and there's something surprising in here to me. I looked and there was a pale green horse. And that took me by surprise, and I haven't checked it out in my Greek New Testament yet, but we'll assume this was, you know, Pale Horse, Pale Rider, who wrote that book? So this is a surprise to hear that, but we'll let it stand for today. The rider's name was Death, and Hades followed with him. Hades is the place where the dead go. They were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword, famine, and pestilence, and by the wild animals of the earth. This is violent death. Not the way any of us would want to die. I mean, we all want to die, fall asleep, and then just pass on. Not by sword, famine, or pestilence. So, here we go. These four horsemen. Inflation and hunger. Violent death. War, maybe civil war and chaos, and invasion. Conquest from the outside. Now, I ask you the question of who is causing these four horsemen of the apocalypse to be unleashed upon the earth? Where do they come from? It is true that the living creature near the throne of God, the living creatures are announcing that they're coming or saying, go ahead. But it seems to me that these four horsemen of the apocalypse are really just the natural consequences of sin. They're what happens because the Roman Empire is based on violence and exploitation and military might. There's nothing surprising about the fact that these things are coming over the earth. When you spend millions of dollars keeping your armies intact, then it's no wonder that people are going hungry because there's not money to put into domestic policy. And so Alan Bosack of South Africa, writing about Revelation, has a passage here. It's almost a page long, and sometimes it can be hard to listen to reading. I'll try to read it with expression, but he says some things. that begin by talking about what was really happening in the lifetime of John, who was writing Revelation, and where he might have gotten some of the symbols that become magnified in these cycles of judgment, that indicate what was happening in the world that would leave us in Thyatira and Sardis feeling uncertain and uncomfortable. And then Bosak makes a connection to what's happening now. John may have been referring to events that he and the church experienced during the last 30 years of his life. John actually lived through a series of catastrophes that touched his life and that of the church deeply. There were the earthquakes of AD 60 AD, the humiliating defeat of the Roman army by the Parthians under Vologesus in 62, the persecutions of the Christians under Nero, which followed the fire of Rome in 64, the horror of the Jewish war, which lasted a full 4 years until the year 70 and ended with the destruction of Jerusalem. There was the suicide of Nero, which was followed by chaos as four claimants battled for the imperial throne. Roman legions loyal to the different opposing contenders clashed with each other constantly for a full year, while as usual, the little defenseless people were pulverized as between great stones. In 79, Vesuvius erupted, obliterating the luxury resorts of the Bay of Naples and creating a pall of darkness so widespread that many feared the imminent dissolution of the physical order. In 92 came the serious grain famine. It would be wrong, however, to believe that John was writing in symbolic language simply to record these events. If that were the case, he need not have used this kind of language at all. Besides, if it were true, the existing straightforward historical accounts would have been sufficient, and John's work should rightly have been discarded as the ravings of a demented individual. But the apocalypse carries a message far more profound. You see, John is telling his church, how true it is that the wages of sin is death. The continued exploitation of the poor, the oppression of the meek and the lowly, shall not go unchallenged or unpunished. God does indeed judge the nations. And sometimes this judgment takes the form of the inevitable results of people's unwillingness to heed the voice of God. There are clear and predictable consequences for the world if human beings continue to rape the earth and plunder its resources, to exploit, oppress, and dominate the weak and the poor for the sake of greed and the hunger for power, to depend on ever-rising levels of violence and ever more lethal instruments of death and destruction in order to secure positions of power and privilege. Many may see these as the lessons of history. For John and the church, it is the voice of God speaking to the church and the world through these historical lessons and events. And it's not just the world that suffers, but the church, as part of the world, is suffering these things as well. And trying to get a handle on what all of this means and speak a word of criticism and of promise, of protest and of hope, in order to clarify the way we believe the world really ought to be, the way God wants the world to be, and the way it's going to continue to be if things don't change and if people don't observe and follow and let themselves be inspired by God's vision. So let's look again, keep going through this cycle here, and then there'll be some real thorny and knotty questions to take up as we go along. I do want to look pretty closely at the next seal, the fifth seal, in chapter 6, verses 9 to 11. Because it's different from the first four. It's not like the four horsemen of the apocalypse. When the Lamb opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who'd been slaughtered for the word of God and for the testimony they'd given. They cried out with a loud voice, "Sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long will it be before you judge and avenge our blood on the inhabitants of the earth?" Is this a Christian question? This is, these are the Christians under the altar, the Christian altar, who have already taken their stand for Jesus as Lord, not Caesar as Lord, and have been put to death for it. And they're saying, avenge our blood on the inhabitants of the earth. What do you think? Is that a fair thing for them to ask? Is it right for them to call out this way? Is it honest for them to call out this way? If it's very human and honest, is it then also right?
Not according to Jesus' teaching.
I think I'd take a look at the Old Testament and see what revenge was in the Old Testament when they were killed.
Eye for eye.
Yes, very much so in the Old Testament.
So by the standards of eye for an eye, this is certainly fair.
I think in God's eyes that was fair in the Old Testament.
Hold on to these thoughts and this question. This is going to keep coming up as we go along. Meanwhile, the answer that these dead ones crying out are given is, here's your white robe, rest a little longer. Until the number will be complete, both of your fellow servants and your brothers and sisters who are soon to be killed as you yourselves have been killed. So, that's the fifth seal. In the sixth seal, there's an earthquake, the sun is black, the moon is red, the stars fall. Notice that even the mighty have to tremble. I bet this is a part that would inspire us in Philadelphia or Thyatira. Then the kings of the earth, verse 15 in chapter 6, then the kings of the earth and the magnates and the generals and the rich and the powerful, and everyone, slave and free, hid in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains, calling to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of the one seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand? We know that at that point, though we are suffering, they are suffering too. And that might do something to satisfy us, does it? Is that an answer to suffering, that they're suffering as well? Well, then, something unusual happens. We've been going, the seals have been opened one by one, and suddenly in chapter 7, there's an interlude. The people who comment on the book of Revelations call these things interludes, as if the real progress of the book of Revelation is in these seals opening, and then suddenly the curtains close for a minute, and someone comes on the front of the stage and does a little tap dance routine and then goes off again on the other side. Then the curtains open and the show continues. But in a way, it seems to me that these interludes are really the main performance, because they're the key to unlocking the meaning of the rest of it. What happens in chapter 7 is that just as we're starting to say, oh no, these terrible signs are happening and the world really is in a mess, we know that already, and here John is saying it's going to continue this way, it can only get worse. Oh no, woe is us, who can stand? We get an answer to that question as 144,000 are sealed. The angel intervenes and says, don't damage the earth or the sea or the trees until we've marked the servants of God with a seal on their foreheads. And then the sealing continues down this whole list of the 12 tribes of Israel, except that this list of the 12 tribes of Israel doesn't correspond to any of the lists of the 12 tribes of Israel we have in the Old Testament. There's a little difference as in what the names of all the tribes are, and notable here is that the tribe of Dan is missing. So I guess I tell you this because some people say, see, 144,000 people are going to be saved and that's it. When 144,000 people have been saved, then the world will end. But it seems to me that this is the spiritual Israel. This is an attempt to say, don't you worry, there's room for all of us of God's faithful people. The number 144,000 is, after all, 12 times 12 times 1,000 And in an age before computers, when you could only count or assemble a pile of stones, that was 144,000. This is almost an unimaginably big number. And the chapter goes on with that kind of reassurance as well. Verse 9, after this I looked and there was a great multitude that no one could count. I mean, if you can make it to 144,000, you've done well, but nobody could count how many are really going to be standing before the throne of God and the Lamb when salvation has occurred. From all tribes, every nation, not just the ones of Israel, all peoples and languages, every ethnic group, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, robed in white, with palm branches in their hands, crying out, salvation belongs to God, and more worship of God. And at the end of this chapter 7, a little preview of the end of the book of Revelation with the promise that there's not going to be any more hunger or thirst, no more sun striking them or scorching heat. These must be people who can't afford the houses that would keep them cool during the day. The Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. That's such a nice image. The Lamb turns to the guide or the shepherd. And the Lamb will guide them to springs of the water of life. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. God knows and cares and will do something about it. So it seems to me that this is a kind of a star performance that sets us on track again, lest we get carried away with worry or fear or anxiety about all the signs and tribulations and turmoil and chaos happening in the world around us. And so the question for us becomes how to interleave this vision and this promise with our day-to-day life in this kind of world where the consequences of sin are so clearly about us. And with the challenges we have about how to live as God's faithful people in a world that runs amok, where people are hungry, where children are abused, and the list goes on and on. And then there's another surprising thing, and that is when the seventh seal is opened at the beginning of chapter 8, there's silence for half an hour. And then the prayers of all the saints rise before God, and nothing really terrible happens. And it's almost like, so was that the seventh seal, or did the seventh seal never happen, or possibly, when the seventh seal was opened, the seventh seal contained the seven trumpets, the next cycle of judgment. If there had been seven seals clearly, then maybe the judgment of God would have been over, because seven is the number of completeness. But with this way, it sort of dissolves. At the end here, we have room for another seven. The same thing happens at the end of this, too. There's an interlude, and then again, I just erased the one, and then again, the seventh trumpet is a surprise. But with the seven bowls, the seven judgments happen one after another. And in fact, at the beginning of the seven bowls, it says, this is it. These are the last plagues. There aren't going to be any more because with this, the wrath of God is completed. And here we do get to number seven. And the last thing that happens, Rome is destroyed, clearing the way for the new heaven and the new earth and for the world to start again and be reborn in its freshness. So we can look more closely at some of these things. Let me point out that there's a several chapter break between this seven trumpets and the seven bowls. And that's because, in a way, the book of Revelation has a mirror structure, and at the center of the mirror, or it's like a stone dropped in the water, it ripples go out. When you start at the beginning of the book of Revelation, you're starting with some of the ripples. And when you get to the chapters that are indicated in the gap here, chapters 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15, you're at the place where the stone is going in the water and the ripples are being sent out. It's a section of Revelation we'll look at tomorrow. But on both sides of this, there are mirroring sorts of things, seven before, seven after. And the beginning of Revelation is like the promise that's fulfilled by the end of Revelation. So that's why I think that Revelation is like a journey in which you go in and turn around and come out a different way than you went in. You go in as frightened people wondering how you're going to give a faithful witness to God or if it's even worth it to do it. And through these strange experiences with dragons and beasts and plagues and whatnot and everything else, you discover that God is faithful and true. And as you come around in orbit on the other side, you're kind of like orbiting around God to at least be faithful. Maybe not to change the world, but then your call is not to change the world. Your call is to be faithful. And so this is kind of the voyage in, and then that big sun in the section that we won't look at today, and then coming back out again. Rome finally is destroyed, and the world is going to be a different place. But there's some fascinating questions along the way. Let me just tell you about the seven trumpets in the second cycle of judgment. First one, hail and fire mixed with blood. One third of the earth, trees, and all the green grass are burned. Second trumpet, something like a mountain all ablaze, headed into the sea. One third of the sea turns to blood, one third of the sea creatures are destroyed, and one third of the ships are destroyed. Third, the star wormwood falls and poisons one third of the rivers and springs. Fourth, one third of the sun, moon, and stars are struck dark. The day is cut by one third and the night totally dark. For a third. My notes don't remind me exactly of how that works, but if you're looking, you might be able to be more precise. Third of the day was kept from shining, and likewise the night. Now, what about all those four together? These are cosmic physical events that have fallen on the earth, afflicting one third of it. Fearful convulsions of nature. Where do these come from? And what's their aim? Well, if we don't know yet, we can keep reading and find out. At this point, an eagle comes in and says, "Woe, woe, and woe to the inhabitants of the earth at the blast of the other trumpets that the three angels are about to blow." And so the fifth trumpet, the first woe, at the beginning of chapter 9, a star falls from heaven to earth, and he, the star, was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit, or the abyss in other language, and he opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, and from the shaft rose smoke like a great furnace. It's really a wonderful, frightening description. If you shut your eyes and imagine it on a screen in front of you or something like that, it's pretty spooky. The sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from the shaft. Then from the smoke came locusts on the earth, and they were given authority like the authority of scorpions of the earth. They were told not to damage the grass of the earth or any green growth or any tree, but only those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. They were allowed to torture them for 5 months, but not to kill them. And their torture was like the torture of a scorpion when it stings someone. And in those days, people will seek death, but will not find it. They'll long to die, but death will flee from them. In appearance, the locusts were like horses equipped for battle. On their heads were what looked like crowns of gold. Their faces were like human faces, their hair like women's hair, their teeth like lion's teeth. They had scales like iron breastplates, and the noise of their wings was like the noise of many chariots with horses rushing into battle. They have tails like scorpions with stingers, and in their tails is their power to harm people for 5 months. They have as king over them the angel of the bottomless pit. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek he's called Apollyon. This is what makes Revelation famous and little red, because you go, yeah, so? What's this about? You don't know whether to be scared. scared or how to take it.
Do you take it literally?
Do you take it literally? I don't think you can take it literally. I think this is a combination of, this is like science fiction. This is like our imagination of what an alien is like. It is emotionally true. It's emotionally true. But my own reading of it is that it's not literally or historically true. It is very real in the feelings that it pictures, describes, brings up, allows us to express. And what are the feelings? Feelings of being overwhelmed, feelings of, you can help me out here, what feelings did you have as I read that?
Fear of destruction.
Fear of destruction. Fear of the world not being a safe place. Fear of something outside your control looming up over you that is just something beyond what you can do anything about. Fear of the fear of feeling like such a tiny cog in such a big system that what you do doesn't make a difference and destruction is going to be the end.
Is this something we can look at in, it's written to the seven churches in Turkey. So is it something for them that happened then? Is it something for us of things to come? Or is it telling us the way it is now or, you know?
You ask questions that people have been asking since they have been reading the book of Revelation. And there are so many schools of thought on that. They can be grouped in different categories. So that some people say, this only made sense to the churches in Turkey, and its meaning was exhausted at that point, and we don't even need to read Revelation anymore. There are other people at another extreme who say, nothing in the book of Revelation has happened yet, because it's about the end of time. And so it hasn't started, or maybe it's just getting started now. And that's when we start looking at them and saying, oh, these locusts from hell, well, this must be, who are the locusts from hell? And that depends, doesn't it, on where you live? I would imagine the Native Americans, if they'd had the book of Revelation, would have said, these white people are the locusts from hell. I wonder if the Iraqis, if they had read the book of Revelation, would have said, these Americans and all these bombs dropping from the coalition, these are the locusts from hell. People in America who tend to write books about it tend to say the Russians or the Egyptians or somebody else overrunning Israel are the locusts from hell. But it obviously depends where you live and what you think is important in history and what impinges you. So it's an open question. My own solution to it is, the way I read it is, this book definitely did make sense to those churches in Turkey. I don't think they would have kept the book of Revelation if it hadn't made sense to them. They would have said, this is the ravings of a lunatic. Throw this one out. Actually, Revelation was received warmly as scripture very early on. And so it meant something then. And then people who have read Revelation have found something in it for so many other times. Alan Bosack reads it and understands his situation in South Africa more clearly. People, the Confessing Church in Germany at the time of Hitler read it, and one of the pastors said, oh, Revelation is an active volcano. I begin to see what sense it makes. It's talking about Hitler. And any oppressed group, it was relevant in Korea at the time. The communists were coming in, and Christians in the South were preaching from Revelation. The story of the world kind of repeats in different ways, but the story of Revelation as a story can be an inspiration to us again and again, particularly to people who are oppressed, hurt, exploited, wondering how to be faithful in an overwhelming and difficult world, who feel like they're being ground under somebody's heel. I think that Revelation makes the most sense to people who are who need to be liberated, who are longing for liberation, who are crying out, how long is this, whatever, going to go on? But what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, so then, Joan, you think that the book of Revelation doesn't have a lot of meaning to those of us who don't think that we're oppressed and are not longing for.
What do you think?
Well, of course I think I'm oppressed and longing for liberation.
But it could then also have a message for the oppressor, wouldn't it?
What chapter does it say in John that blessed are those who study the book of Revelation? There's a special blessing.
There's a special blessing right at the beginning of chapter 1 that says, blessed is one who reads this, and the picture there is that it's going to be read out loud in church services, and blessed are the ones who hear. And then at the end of the book, again, there's a keep these words and read them, that kind of instruction.
So isn't that a part from saying, study these words for they will come true?
That's how some people take it, yeah.
You mentioned a couple of times that one's not called to change the world to be faithful, but in the examples you used, you mentioned the German resistance, you used Korea, yeah. The communists, South Africa. Certainly, there's an earthly good to revelations other than just being faithful. How does one use the book of Revelations to be not only faithful, but to be a citizen, to be political?
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that that's a question that we might wrestle with.
Yeah.
Because to be faithful, we'll say, is, well, turn the other cheek. That's what Jesus said we should do, although they didn't have access to that. So what does it mean to be faithful?
Yeah, for me, part and parcel of being faithful is being a citizen. And so I didn't mean to imply an escapist kind of faithfulness.
I know you didn't, but okay. I'm wanting to push the question.
And so, yes, the question is, what do you want to do with that?
Well, I'm tossing it out. I said, what does it mean then to be faithful to Jesus in the midst of this persecution that these churches were under? And the examples that you use in our own day and age, what does it mean to be faithful to Jesus when you're being persecuted by a government that doesn't care much for who you are, be it South Africa, Latin America?
The question that Nancy asked makes me say, yeah, what if so-called Christians in the West are Rome?
Well, that's why I was thinking, if there's a message here for the oppressed, there's also a message, woe be to the oppressor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In response to his question, to be faithful means to also support and call on others to be faithful or encourage others to be faithful. And that may take on a political realm. And by calling others to be faithful, or reminding others to be faithful as part of your work of being faithful, may change, or may bring change. That might be a byproduct of your being faithful, rather than the number one goal. I don't think change is an end. I think it's a means to carry on your faithfulness.
So what is it you think that we, if we were to make a faithful witness now, what do you think might change in the world? I give you permission to dream and be visionaries. You don't have to tell me how this would be accomplished, but just go ahead and say what the results would be. In fact, I live in Portland, and I recently ran across a very interesting newspaper published by the Portland Greens, the political party. They tried to envision the Portland area in like the year 2015 or something like that, and describe what they would like it to be like in terms of having green spaces in the country and urban transit and places for bike racks in all of the urban transit. And it was just really a positive vision. It was very inspiring. And they didn't say how they were going to get to there from here. You don't have to do that right now either, figure out how to get from here to there. But tell me where there is that you would like to be in the world.
I would have to say the value of all humanity recognized.
more ideas, more values, more hopes and dreams.
I saw a poster here last year that said, a modest proposal for peace. You know that one? The Christians of the world agree to stop killing each other. That would be a good start.
Some more?
That the world would be a safe place for children without hunger and abuse and poverty.
Mm-hmm. Some more?
The world would be a community like this community where people value each other and care for each other.
Some more?
Somehow you could drink the water below the camp instead of above. That's a good use.
Some more?
Yeah, that human beings that know can understand their connection to the resources of the world and how important they are, that we don't destroy everything, that we recycle and all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Some more?
Just that all the different Christian churches could talk and get along instead of fighting about little things.
When you were talking about the inflation and the hunger in chapter 6, and I couldn't, I was remembering something in the paper, in our local paper, where it showed CEOs, and I don't mean to offend anybody, but salary like yay, and all the rest of us kind of over here, if we were fortunate enough to be somewhat economically stable. I think that something needs to be done so that everybody has the dignity of food and shelter and a sense of self-worth.
Mm-hmm. And this is very much the spirit of the end of the book of Revelation, chapters 21 and 22, and we have a new heaven and a new earth. And so then the practical question arises of how do we get there from here? And whether we agree or not, I think part of the answer of the book of Revelation is that somehow evil has to be dealt with. And how can we deal with evil? How can we get people to see their evil and stop it? I mean, presumably we're preaching to the converted, preaching to the choir right here. You know, we all have this vision and share it. How's the world at large out there going to get this vision? So the section of Revelation that we're in right now is a proposal of a way that that could happen. You don't necessarily have to agree that it's the best way, but part of the way is the consequences of sin are going to have their way in the world, and people will be able to see in large scale what the results of their action are. The only problem is that the people with power are generally not the ones who are suffering. And what happens in this series of judgments is that the people in power get the suffering turned against them. We start at the beginning with the results of sin beginning to turn against them. People from outside are using armies against Rome. And there's chaos and civil war within Rome, and a lot of people are hurt by inflation and hunger. And then when the whole cosmos gets involved, well, if God would stop providing rain on the just and the unjust alike, the unjust wouldn't be able to keep on doing what they were doing for very long. And that's what's happening in these cataclysmic series of things in the seven trumpets. And in the mythological kinds of locusts from hell and armies from hell that rise up towards the end of the seven trumpets, where things are written on such a big scale that it's being done against Rome. Now, is this fantasy or is this reality? Is it going to work? Is it going to convince the Romans? Are they going to change their minds? Or is it simply going to comfort us, the oppressed people, because at least we've seen what they deserve, even if it never happens? Or even if it only happens in another world. I mean, is this a satisfying solution? Is this going to work as part of the process from getting where we are to that new heaven and new earth? What do you think?
I
think what? You said just the idea of hope, that to show the people, you know, Rome has always been presented, at least to the people of that time, as something unconquerable. And just even to be shown the picture that maybe in your dreams it is conquerable, and just even giving them that thought that there is the possibility somewhere down the line. Because I think just the way Rome presented itself was that there was no way it was ever going to be conquered. And just even that idea, you talked about how they control the mind. And if you even have a flicker of hope that maybe somewhere it's going to change, that gives you the hope to go on.
So it's a very subversive and liberating thought. And if we can think of Rome as no longer having the last word, maybe we'll find ways to do it.
But it's a very horrifying thought when we see ourselves as participating in Rome. I mean, it's easy to sort of keep it historical. But,
that's right.
You know, to be honest, I'm part oppressor. I mean, we live in a wealthy country and enjoy its benefits. Mm-hmm. It's not at all satisfying process to me. Mm-hmm. To struggle to get through it. I mean, to look at this and try to see where we are, mm-hmm. to discern where we are in this, where I am in this.
Yeah.
When you first started reading chapter 9, it reminded me of, just before we got to the locust part, which is this bottomless pit in the snake, of the Indian prophecy where this Mount St. Helens was sort of like little sister blowing its top, and Rainier is like the grandfather that eventually will blow its top. And I kept thinking of Rainier when I read this section. Mm-hmm. Of all those physical things in the middle there, the trumpets that we have no control over, where the top part we do as a people.
And we take those physical things as a message. Think of the people in Bangladesh or the Philippines, and how would you imagine that you would feel if you were part of the devastation of the cyclone or of the volcano? We do use those things that we have no control over to somehow inform us about our situation and what our life is like.
I think it's important to, again, to talk about it in terms of the oppressor and the oppressed. We embody both of it. It's just to identify what the spirit of our faith is. This, you know, we talked yesterday a little bit about the spirit of the churches. You know, what is the spirit of our Lutheran church? What is the spirit of our faith that we can identify and help identify and understand the historical times that we are in, and how we are neither cold nor hot or lukewarm. Yesterday was the spirit of hope, and what is the spirit of our own faith that allows the oppressor to continue to guide ourselves, guide our lives? Because more often than not, the examples you use at Revelation is a gift to churches under persecution. And there's an apocalyptic language to Bozak and to other people, that things will change and God is going to bring about those changes. And we may be the instruments for those changes.
In some ways, I don't want to give a gospel promise too soon at this part, because I think it's important to struggle with the questions and to try to find our place in it, and to not close it off too soon and tidy it up, but to let the book of Revelation and its apocalyptic language work on us, fermenting like yeast turning grape juice into wine, or whatever the image is like. But again, there is, with these interludes, an indication of the truth that is the first word, the Alpha and the Omega, the last word that we move toward. And again, there's a star performance in chapters 10 and 11. And again, there's no seventh trumpet. You think, well, the whole world is falling apart, volcanoes and earthquakes and bloody water and all that sort of stuff. Does this mean the destruction of the world when the seventh trumpet comes?
And instead, in place of the seventh trumpet, there is a song of glory and thanksgiving. Because God is not interested in the destruction of the world. God made the world and loves the world and wants to redeem the world. And so with this, in spite of the pharaohs, in spite of Rome, in spite of the hunger and the poverty, God is sticking with the world. And again, judgment doesn't happen and crash down at the end of the seven trumpets. And this whole interlude section that we will look at tomorrow, if you come back to that, is about a faithful witness and God's promises. Then with the seven bowls, just to give them a lift and a promise, there are seven plagues. And if plagues mean anything to people versed in the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, plagues mean that this is trying to get through to Egypt. But whether or not you get through to Egypt, and whether or not Pharaoh changes his mind, God will accomplish a liberation, and the people will be freed. So that's what happens here. And whereas these affected a third of the earth, these affect the whole earth. The bowl is poured on the earth, into the sea, into all the fresh water, the rivers and springs. This bowl is poured on the sun. This bowl is poured on the throne of power in Rome. And this bowl, this gets ready for the final battle at Armageddon. The bowl is poured, I forget where that bowl is poured, and this one is poured into the air. So you see, by pouring it into all those places, the whole created order is entirely destroyed, symbolically, mythologically, in these images, in this storytelling. Rome splits into three parts, Babylon, it says, splits into three parts and dissolves, and the way is cleared for the new creation and for starting over. God's wrath is ended. Well, then we have a couple more chapters where the end of Rome is spelled out in more gory detail so that we can really rejoice in every little bit of it's falling apart. And then the new creation comes in at the end. I hope you'll be able to come back for more of that, but otherwise, keep wrestling with that question of how God works in the world to show evil its own face and to call us to repentance.
Thank you, Joel.